The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
These nutty ideas, those that are propagated by people who call themselves cat turd and Bronze Age pervert and all these other things, they are so close to those in power. They really are like the guidance that people like Vance and Vogt and Stephen Miller and all of these people are being guided by, right? Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us on the Mona Charon Show. I'm delighted this week to welcome Laura K. Field. She is an advisor to the Illiberal Studies Program at George Washington University and a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. Also, she is the author of a very important new book called Furious Minds, The Making of the MAGA New Right. This is the book. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Mona, for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
First question, what prompted you to write this book?
Well, I'll give you the sort of medium length version of this, but I'm a political theorist by training and studied mainly with conservative Straussians. So, you know, followers of Leo Strauss. And then I was in that world for quite a long time. And then in 2016, when Trump won the first time, I was pretty shocked to discover that Michael Anton at the Claremont Institute had written this big pro-Trump screed, essentially this intellectual defense of Trumpism. And that was sort of an adjacent world, right? That was a world that was sort of familiar to me that I was, you know, not of, but sort of next to. And I thought, wow, that's crazy. So I started watching that pretty closely. Just the kind of development of the conservative, what I call the MAGA New Right, this sort of intellectual defense of Trumpism. And I started writing about that eventually for The Bulwark and some other outlets. And honestly, after January 6th, I thought that would be the end of it. I sort of thought they would take the off ramp and the movement would die down. But instead, it kind of consolidated. They started taking over, you know, the Heritage Foundation. And the momentum just kept going. And so then I thought it was in about 2022 that I started pitching the book idea.
One of the architects of January 6th, of the legal rationale for January 6th, was John Eastman, who was affiliated with Claremont. Is it safe to say the Claremont Institute is now pretty much a MAGA organ?
I mean, I think so. It's sort of still this complex thing where there's sort of the upper sort of highbrow Claremont Review of Books that publishes some serious people, presents itself as this sort of sophisticated thing and is not all MAGA for sure. They'll publish critical arguments but then there's this very sort of active political branch in the American mind, and then the leadership of the Institute. The editor of the Claremont Review of Books is one thing, but the leadership of the Institute, I think, is full on MAGA, very much driving a lot of what's happening on the right.
Okay. So I have a sort of preliminary question that I've been unsuccessful in finding the answer to for years. Okay. So I came up as part of, you know, the conservative movement and started out at National Review with William F. Buckley, who was my hero at the time when I was in college, and very familiar with the whole commentary world, the Weekly Standard, all of that. And I was always hearing about the Straussians, the followers of Leo Strauss. And I didn't do a deep dive into it, but I sort of tried to figure out, well, what are Straussians? What is it? And people would say, well, it's taking the ancients seriously. It's reading the ancients. And I thought, okay, fine. But I mean, I wasn't aware that other people weren't reading the ancients. I mean, I went to Columbia, and at Columbia, there was the, you know, contemporary civilization course and humanities. Yeah. Everybody read Plato and Aristotle, and that was just part of the canon, right? So I wasn't aware that they were sort of neglected. Maybe they were. But then there's another wrinkle to it where people say, no, but it's the kind of reading of the ancients where it's a code. And you have to sort of decrypt, like, what the secret messages are in the ancients. Am I going too far? Because that, to me, almost sounds like, you know, the postmodernists, you know, where you have to deconstruct text. Tell me, what is this Straussian stuff? You were trained by Straussians, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was trained by Straussians. And in a way, you know, you're not going too far. It is this kind of decoding, secret teaching stuff. I mean, I don't think that is all just nonsense or a conspiracy. I mean, I think there's some real truth to all of that. So I'm still sort of Straussian. I'm a bit of a defector from the Straussian world, but I'm also sort of still Straussian enough to be able to defend some of that. But basically, I mean, you're right. I think on the face of it that the classics have not been forgotten. And it's one of the things that makes me crazy about the Straussians is they sort of think they're the only ones who really get it. But they are reading in a different way. And there's a kind of care and carefulness with it that sort of does a little more justice to, I think, how many of these texts, and we are talking about Plato, Aristotle, and not just the ancients. I think that many Straussians also take modern philosophy very seriously, and Leo Strauss did. So, but the idea being that these texts are written with sort of a level of care and sophistication that it's almost analogous to like a symphony orchestra. There's a kind of genius involved. And with the writing, it's kind of multi-layered. It's this idea that Plato wrote dialogues, not treatises, because he wanted to kind of preserve some mystique almost, that there are secret, I mean, the Straussians go very far in like secret esoteric teachings. And I think that's a bit silly because part of it's also just like a pedagogical necessity that you don't want to be this didactic sort of bearing, you know, teaching the truth with a capital T to your students. If you're a real teacher, you want people to think for themselves. If you're a philosopher, you want to kind of allow people to discover wisdom. And also a big part of it, though, is just persecution, right? That a lot of ideas are dangerous, right? Or many at least have been historically. And so the idea is that a philosopher, in order to kind of maybe leave some uncertainty there and to not be killed like Socrates was, will sort of layer their texts with ambiguity. So, I mean, it doesn't get, that's sort of the simplest version.
Okay. Okay.
That I think is a real thing in, you know, in the history of political philosophy. But it can get more complicated than that.
Right. So a lot of people who are antagonistic toward Trump and Trumpism tend to think that there aren't any intellectual underpinnings there, that he is mm-hmm. He's such an idiot and so mm-hmm. stupid and says such ridiculous things that mm-hmm. There's a tendency to say this whole movement is like him.
Yeah.
I think you're at pains to say, even though you disagree with the conclusion they come to, but that these are actually pretty smart and learned, and some of them, and thoughtful people, right? And so you want us to take their ideas seriously.
Yeah, I mean, on a certain level, I get it, the critique of Trump, certainly. And I wouldn't say stupid, but he's certainly in sort of an intuitive person, not a big thinker. And I think
Laura.
No.
He said the other day that you could reduce prices by 6,000%.
I know, but it's part of the shtick. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's just going for it. He's just saying whatever he wants. I mean, yes. I mean, I totally grant the point. My argument is partly that his anti-intellectualism provides kind of a camouflage for the people I'm writing about. So it's
okay.
Like, I totally grant. There's an anti-intellectual. I mean, I'm just. Yeah, you're right. Okay. But on the Trump, it's like he's got something, and it's politically savvy, right?
Yeah.
Successful or effective. But it's kind of so different from some of what's grown up underneath him and like this movement that I'm writing about that it's almost like hiding in plain sight. This pretty sophisticated intellectual movement. And I am, as you say, like, I'm walking a fine line because I'm not, these are not scholars who I admire and respect in most instances. I mean, there are a couple who I think are quite brilliant and I enjoy reading because of that. And I can get into it, but, and certainly they're leaning on legacies that are kind of important and interesting,
mm-hmm.
but there's also a part of it where it's just like scholars or so-called scholars who have been sort of stuck in these insular worlds for so long that they're not clear thinkers. They never contest, you know, they never really check their views against the historical record. Like there are big problems with who I'm writing about, but the thing is that it's really sort of, overly smug and there's a kind of idiocy in assuming that they're not sophisticated and smart because, I mean, part of what I say in the book is that, you know, we are in academia, especially everybody's so sort of specialized and siloed that there are plenty of issues where I don't even respect some of the people I'm writing about, but I wouldn't want to go head to head to them in like a debate about the founding fathers because they are learned. They have a huge amount of historical knowledge at their fingertips. I think they manipulate a lot of that and they're not mm-hmm. using it in sort of a full sort of coherent way that's, you know, generous to criticism and all, like there are all kinds of problems with it, but there's also there is a sophistication there and they've certainly shown how effective they can be partly through their willingness to manipulate the truth, right?
So in a nod to the ancients, we can say they're sophists.
Well, some of them are, yeah. Or they engage in sophistry, right? Yeah. I mean, there's never, when Plato was writing, there wasn't a clear line between the sophist and the philosopher. He had to kind of forge that rhetorically. Do you mm-hmm. know what I mean? I mean, mm-hmm. so we have to, I think there, I mean, I could give examples where I think they're being sophistical.
Right.
And they're using the truth in order to get power or, you know, achieve
sure.
their own ends.
So, speaking of that, one of the things that has always brought me up short when confronting some of these MAGA intellectuals is that they speak constantly in terms of Western civilization and saving Western civilization and that Western civilization is under attack from the left and from, you know, people that they disparage. And yet their vision of what Western civilization is seems to omit the entire Enlightenment.
Yeah. Right? Absolutely.
What's your, okay.
No, that's right. I mean, the Straussians in particular and the West Coast Straussians who are sort of this Claremont group that I write about, they're extremely critical of the Enlightenment and even of the Enlightenment strains in the American founding, even though they sort of purport to hold the founding so high. It's mm-hmm. it's a very strange kind of amalgam of how they understand this. And you're right, across the board, you know, I'm writing about all these different camps, including many of these sort of conservative Catholics and nationalists. And they almost too, this was sort of shocking to me in writing it and researching them and sort of getting to the bottom of what they actually believe. Yeah, they're anti-Enlightenment, sort of anti-reason in a way, though they claim to be the only true upholders of reason. And the other thing they do is they are extremely monolithic in their understanding of Western civilization as such. I mean, if there's one thing that I think Western civilization stands for, it's a, especially in modernity, right? It's a kind of pluralism. It's this, you know, Strauss talks about the ancients and the moderns, and he talks about reason versus revelation as like, these are different parts of our inheritance, right? We've got the monotheistic religious traditions, right? Which are also plural. Like there's not many Christians who, you know, there are all these denominations, there are all these arguments amongst these groups. And then there's the inheritance of Athens, including like pagans and the Homeric, you know, Plato was very different from Homer. It's all extremely diverse and rich, and it also embraces questioning. And so the version of Western civ that they're trying to preserve isn't that. It's not the one I recognize. And even Leo Strauss, I mean, I have this in a footnote somewhere in the book. You know, he admitted he loved Western civ and all he ever wrote about were basically, you know, dead white male authors who were geniuses. And he loved that as much as anyone you could imagine. And he also admitted that we can't know whether how this tradition holds up next to traditions that come from other parts of the world. Life is too short for us to know that with any certainty, you know? And so he was open to comparative literature and to other rich traditions, which we can assume, even if we don't know them, are probably just as rich as our own. So I don't know. To me, Western civ includes that kind of openness And I wouldn't call it Western. I mean, if I were writing an agenda for, you know, a propagandistic defense of something, it wouldn't be Western Civ, right? I think that's too narrow.
Right. So one of the things also along the same lines, and you have a sort of taxonomy in the book of the different groups that make up the MAGA intellectual world, such as it is, and we can get into who they are. You've divided, I think, into four groups, if I got that correct. But one of them is the National Conservatives. And this is that group that was started by Yoram Hazony, who is actually Israeli, but where he argues on behalf of nationalism, and he argues that the nation state is the natural sort of organizing principle in the world and that nothing else has legitimacy. But, you know, he and the people around him, especially in this NatCon movement, are constantly talking about how you have to have a homogeneous cultural identity. Mm-hmm. And I am hard put to think of a country that has a homogeneous cultural identity. Countries can have majorities where there's where one predominates, but pretty much every country has minorities within it. Right. And how you deal with minorities and how you respect the rights of minorities is a crucial question in political philosophy. Right. And it's something that we regard as a great accomplishment of the American system in that we give rights to everyone based on their individuality, not on their group membership.
Yeah. Yeah, and a hard fought right, you know, right. Yeah. Obviously. I mean, something that many people fought and died for, and I mean, it seems like a pretty recent achievement historically, right?
Yeah, we've only given rights to African Americans since the 1960s. I mean, it hasn't been very long at all. It's been within my lifetime.
And women, right? We've had rights longer, but it's something that's obviously been very easy for people to take for granted, or we wouldn't be in this mess. So, I mean, I don't think we can just, one of the things that they're banking on is that we've sort of forgotten how to defend those things and have taken too much for granted. But I think, there's this with Hazony and the NatCons, and they're the most sort of simple version of this, where they're just, Yoram Hazony comes along and says, a nation state has to be one thing, homogenous in religion, relatively homogenous. I mean, he doesn't speak in terms of ethnic nationalism, but he says you do need sort of a shared culture, a shared religion, a shared history, a shared language. So it veers up pretty closely to a kind of ethnic nationalism. And he basically concedes that will mean that minorities have different rights or are sometimes, cast to the side. That's all a little fuzzy in terms of what that actually means for minorities, but it doesn't, you don't have to be super woke, social justice warrior to know that really threatens, that's threatening people now. They're acting on this, obviously, and it's pretty sinister. And so, and especially with regards to America, I mean, I think you're right. At this time in history, and probably all throughout history, without extraordinarily violent measures, you do not have no place is homogenous in that way, right?
Right, right.
And when they tried for it, it didn't go, it was, unless you are a freakish kind of ethnic nationalist who's willing to sacrifice people on the altar of purity and believe in that, it doesn't go well historically.
It's very dangerous. Who are some of the names that viewers and listeners would recognize on the American scene who identify as NatCons now?
You know, that's a good question because everything's so fluid right now.
It is fluid. But would you put J.D. Vance?
I think J.D. Vance, absolutely. And Russ Vaught, who's the, up there in the administration.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Rubio. I would put Rubio in there
Rubio
now.
Yeah, Rubio Hawley, I think, is still in there. And then there's all the sort of the thinkers, too. Like Patrick Deneen has sort of occasionally put some distance between himself and the NatCons, but he was at the last NatCon conference, and he's certainly still sticking to Deneen. Peter Thiel, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know about Musk and Andreessen. I just don't know exactly. Curtis Yarvin is one of these people who's sort of all over the place. But I think
he's the monarchist, right?
He's the monarch. I mean, I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, all the people, basically, they're the big umbrella group. So the whole cast of characters almost, I mean, Adrian Vermeule, they have some theoretical differences with certain parts of the nationalist model, but it doesn't seem to be stopping them in practical terms.
I'd like to take a minute and talk to you about One Skin, which is delicious. Well, I don't eat it, but it is wonderful topical moisturizer. I'm, of course, in the winter, really, really dry skin. My hands crack. My face feels tight, but not after you put this on. Not only does it make your skin look smoother, but it has this quality where you smooth it on, it's immediately like you feel like you can relax, all that tightness goes away, but it's very, very smooth and not greasy. I don't like greasy skin ointments and things. I find I'll just wash them off because it bothers me. But this, it just absorbs right away into your skin and it feels soft but not greasy. So how do they do it? Well, it's their OS1 peptide, the first ingredient proven to target senescent cells, the root cause of wrinkles, crepiness, and loss of elasticity, all key signs of skin aging. These results have been validated in 5 different clinical studies. It is also safe for sensitive skin. The One Skin, all of their products are free from over 1,500 harsh or irritating ingredients. It's all dermatologist tested, and they've been awarded the National Eczema Association Seal of Acceptance. Customers consistently rave about how their skin is smoother, firmer, and healthier looking, with results that get better over time, improving both the appearance and the overall health of their skin. No wonder One Skin's products have over 10,000 five-star reviews. Special offer. Get up to 30% off One Skin with the code MonaCharon at www.oneskin.co/MonaCharon. Once again, for 30% off One Skin, go to www.oneskin.co/MonaCharon. After your purchase, they'll ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Okay, let's talk about the religious conservatives, the Catholic integralists. Again, I'm going to ask, though, I'm probably being unfair to them, but so cards on the table. I don't like these people. Yeah. I don't think that they have any place. I mean, they can say what they want. It's a free country. But first of all, like a small minority of Americans are Catholic. Okay. That's the first thing. The second thing is, one of the things the nation was founded on was religious liberty. And they are theocrats, right? I mean, they want to establish a country that is run on the principles of Christianity, and specifically mm-hmm. Catholic Christianity. Mm-hmm. What the heck?
Yeah, I mean, there's the argument here, because this gets pretty sophisticated in the old-fashioned sophistical sense pretty fast, right? When you think of, like, Adrian Vermeule is sort of the one, he's the one I'm, to put my cards on the table. I mean, I disagree with all of it, but I think it's fascinating. And I like reading him because he's just clearly, I think, quite brilliant.
He is a smart fellow. Yeah.
Yeah. Like you read, and he loves Carl Schmitt. And
great.
I do not, but I have loved reading Carl Schmitt in the past because there's these kind of punchy arguments and it's just lucid. And there's something of that in Vermeule. So, but then it's so sneaky is the only way I can describe it, because he's got this whole constitutional model for how to understand American jurisprudence that he's trying to use to replace originalism. Mm-hmm. And his argument is that this is the true inheritance from our, including all the, you know, the Protestant and Puritan founders or whatever, that this is our, that the true classical mode of jurisprudence is within this common good framework. And that it's not real religious liberty, that it's kind of limited, and that it's not real. They weren't really after individual freedom. The founders actually understood freedom differently. So there's all this kind of fudging of the truth. And I think that's pretty obvious. I don't think it's me just saying that. I mean, there's a kind of sophistical lie, I would say, in Adrian, at the core of Adrian Vermeule's work on the common good constitutionalism, where he's really trying to project this theocratic, in a way, Catholic model onto American history. I mean, that's obviously tricky. I think that's bad fudge. Like, it's not true. What he's trying to say is true, but there is a kind of latent normativity to America, you know, to constitutional.
What do you mean?
I think his critique of originalism is fair. It's sort of originalism says, you know, you've got this text, you've got this original moment, and that determines everything. But I think a critic of that, and there are critics of that from the left and the center and all over the place, would say, no, those texts are embedded in a richer history, in a kind of principled structure of what the Constitution is aiming for that we should be attending to. Vermeule says that's a Catholic context, effectively. Others would say, well, no, there's, you know, Harry Jaffa might say, no, there's the principles of the Declaration that are the highest thing that we're aiming for, you know, some sort of aspirational principles. So it just gets, there's all kinds of room to maneuver here. But Adrian Vermeule and the Catholics are saying, no, it's just one thing. Whereas I think you and I, our intuition would be like, no, it's a democracy. It's something that we negotiate through history and interpret. Right. And the court has a role, and textualism might be a good place to start, mm-hmm. but it's kind of messy, you know, mm-hmm. but so for these, anyway, I think there's a kind of a real fudging there and an effort to impose this one reading. But let me say what I was trying to get at. He also says it's kind of Christian, that there's this kind of Christian apparatus, and that's where it can kind of combine with Christian nationalists or other ways of understanding American history, that where it's kind of a convenient symbiosis with the Catholics and other parts of the right.
And of course, there's a whole school of Protestant sort of supremacists, yes. out there, who you also discuss in the book. And that's equally disturbing, or more so, because there are more Protestants. But
yeah.
So one of the things that seems to unite this group of thinkers, and it's kind of strange to say this, considering that they have attached themselves to someone who is the most malevolent figure in American history in many respects, namely Donald Trump. But these people, by their own lights, believe that they are here to inaugurate a new era of the common good. In Vermeule's terms, he calls it common good constitutionalism. Others, so Rob Amari and others have talked about how we know what the good is, and we're going to use the power of the state to impose it. So first of all, I find, and I'd be curious to hear what you think. I mean, I don't disagree that we ought to pay attention to arguments about what is the good life? What does it mean to be a good citizen? What does it mean to be a good person? Maybe our schools shouldn't shy away from things like that when it comes to education. You know, those mm-hmm. are existential questions that will always be with us and that are important to grapple with. And so maybe that part of their critique is fair, maybe, but they immediately then go to, we will use the state to impose our vision of the good. And there's such a lack of, first of all, there's a lack of respect for the system where, you know, you cannot trample other people's rights and coerce people using the power of the state. But also, there's something else, Laura, which is completely lacking in any of these people that I read about in your book. There is one thing that is missing all through all of them, and that is modesty. There's never a sense, well, what if we're wrong? I mean, how will we arrive at truth if we think we have it and we're ready to impose it?
Yeah. Yeah, there's no humility. Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it's really troubling, because I think what we've seen both in Trump and with a lot of the people in my book is that sort of brazenness has a ton of power, especially when things are unsettled and mm-hmm. uncertain. And I think that it's fair to say that, and I'm not, you know, I don't mean to just like beat the liberals over, you know, I don't mean to hammer on them, but I think there is a vulnerability in liberalism. That's sort of one of the sub themes in the book where, as you noted, I mean, the liberal regime is meant to not tell people how sort of in political theory, we talk about comprehensive doctrines, right? Liberalism allows you to choose your way through life. It allows you to choose your religion, and it won't tell you, it won't impose those goods on you. It won't tell you what to believe specifically. And that leaves it kind of vulnerable because, I think you're right in the school systems, right? And it means we don't talk about those things enough. We probably don't talk about what it means to live a good life, what it means to flourish. Liberals, I think, get a little bit shy about those questions, partly because they don't want to impose their views on others. They might have some pretty good, they might have some pretty clear ideas, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I know I do, right?
Yeah.
And there's maybe a real failure there to just even be upfront about the problem. Mm-hmm. But what happens is that these guys come in and they say, well, we have the answers. We have them. We're confident in them. We're not going to question them. We've inherited these for generations. And by the way, we get along with you, Mr. Protestant, and you, Mr. Fascist, and you just well enough to say, to get together and try to impose them on everybody else. So it's really dangerous in that way, even though it, from most of us, I think it sounds absurd, right? Because it doesn't sound plausible, and it's extra absurd because you've got Donald Trump at the head of this thing, who's, you know, just nobody's idea of a good person. Nobody.
Yeah.
Even them, you know, they're pretty upfront about that. Even the Christians who think he's, you know, the new Cyrus admit that he's not, it's kind of a vehicle for them, you know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, so you have all these layers of absurdity, and yet there's a ton of power there.
Yeah.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Now, one other thing that happens, and it's so clear in your book, you do a really, this book is the definition of a deep dive. I mean, you really go into what these people think and really close analysis of their words. Maybe that's your Straussian training right there.
Yeah, I put it to good use, but I do apologize. Some of it's a little much.
But it is amazing how when you dig down on many of these guys, you don't have to dig very far before you're running into outright racism, sexism. We'll get to the whole misogyny theme. I want to hold off on that just for a minute, because that, I think, is a thread running through the book that I want to explore in depth. But it's amazing how, you know, you quote this guy, I think his name was Wolf, who talked about slavery as it was, or did I get that wrong? Was that somebody else?
Douglas Wilson.
Might have been Douglas Wilson, yeah, about, yeah, you know, sort of saying that, you know, he's going to do a reinterpretation of slavery. We gotten it all wrong. They had the greatest relations between the races ever was under slavery. I mean, this kind of bullshit, I'm sorry. I mean, that, yeah, it passes for intellectual argument. I mean, you don't even have to know any history.
Yeah, I mean, that was a weird pamphlet that he kind of, I think, backstepped away from. But that's the kind of, it's a good example of just the kind of crazy mentality that some of these people have been, just sort of the worlds they're circulating in. I mean, even the Claremont guys, there's this chapter I write on the Journal of American Greatness, which is kind of, right, the Flight 93 before the Flight 93, this secretive blog. And those guys were quoting some of the worst racists, you know, Derbyshire, Sam Francis is like the best of them. I mean, and this is just like, I think it was interesting to me because it's like, oh, these guys were marinating in these really icky places before Trump came along. And when Trump came along, they saw what he represented, and they And they were very clear about it. And I think some of them, it was a little ironical and they were being playful and being weird online. Like, I think Julius Krein is a good example of that, because the moment Charlottesville happened, he took the off ramp. He's like the one example in the whole book. And then Sohrab Ahmari at a few points has had a little bit of principle, right? Where he, but Julius Krein said, oh, everybody's been saying that Trump is a racist, that Trump is playing these racial games, that he's using this alphabetic. And I didn't really get it. But now I have to admit, I was wrong this whole time. It became clear to him that that's what was going on.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That one guy.
Mm-hmm. That one guy. And then Sohrab Ahmari, right? Sohrab Ahmari, right. Who I make fun of him a bit in the book. I call him a Where's Waldo of the new movement, because like, where, you know, the guy seems to be on a different page today. Now he's back. He's defending Vance. He's got this new interview out with Vance and whatever. But I just think, you know,
he's a boat with no keel.
Yeah. Anyway, but at a few points he does, he speaks out more vocally than anybody against some of the the Bronze Age pervert and the Curtis Yarvin and Elon Musk, but like, okay. But they still seem pretty silent on a lot of the
it
other
does
stuff.
And tell you a lot about our era, that somebody who calls himself Bronze Age pervert is a thinker that people have to grapple with. I mean, that's also another theme of your book, which is, you know, I mean, there are always nutty ideas in circulation. There are plenty of nutty ideas on the left. And all over the place. Mm-hmm. But these nutty ideas, those that are propagated by people who call themselves cat turd and Bronze Age pervert and all these other things, they are so close to those in power. They really are like the guidance that people like Vance and Vogt and Stephen Miller and all of these people are being guided by, right?
Well, I think with some of those names you listed, it's at least like they're reading it, they're thinking it's fun and exciting, and I think the staffers are certainly kind of invested in some of that, right? It's sort of the young, that's kind of like the culture warriors, the manosphere. A lot of that energy is coming from those people, and I'm sure a lot of those young people reading that stuff are not all on board with it, right? They're just kind of, it's just something exciting and
countercultural
and transgressive. But then it starts to, it's almost like a trickle up. That's what I think with the misogyny thing, Mona. It's like, I did not expect it to be such a major theme in the book, but it is, I think, some, like the worst of it is, of course, like Bronze Age pervert, Stephen Wolfe, raw egg nationalists, these really far gone characters who write about the gynocracy and the longhouse and the basically.
What's the longhouse? I didn't know.
The longhouse is this idea that they all have some sort of term for the elites who are our overlords, right? And so there's the cathedral is Curtis Yarvin's version of that. You know, it could just be the managerial elite, the liberalocracy, that's Deneen's, right? But the longhouse is Curtis Yarvin's phrase for it. And also, Jonathan Kieperman or Lomez has written about it for First Things magazine, of all places. But the longhouse is a term referring to the sort of ancient longhouses, both of Native Americans, but they can be found all over the world. Sort of anthropologists have seen this, that are basically matriarchal housing systems where you've got the women in charge. And so for Bronze Age pervert, modernity, the world we're in now, is best represented by the longhouse, because we are being tyrannized by women and their and womanly impulses of, you know, compassion and kindness and all of these things. And so that's what it's tyrannizing over that. And wokeness, right, is another.
That sounds like Nietzsche, actually.
Yeah. Well, it is like, it's like Nietzsche, but with no sense of humor. I mean, actually, I shouldn't say that. Bronze Age pervert is kind of funny, but it's like Nietzsche on steroids with no sense of humor and no subtlety whatsoever and no generosity of spirit. I mean, I'm not going to stand here and defend Nietzsche, though I'm tempted. But, you know, Nietzsche has these horrible misogynist things to say, but at least it's kind of funny. And you get the feeling, at least I do as a woman, that he's kind of trying to play both sides. And he says, it's just kind of this, I think it's a much more generous sort of spirit, but this guy's, this is violent and, you know, aggressively anti-woman. And it's anyway. And so
this is true of a lot of them. A lot of these, the hard right, a lot of what seems to be motivating them is real misogyny, hatred of women. And you see it not only among men, but you see it among women, like Helen Andrews's piece.
Well, that's the thing. Like Helen Andrews's piece is basically just laundering Bronze Age pervert. And it's kind of, it's just so absurd and so childish, you know?
Yeah. The truth is, though, that there is a kernel of reality underneath this fury that they would not excusing for a single second their misogyny. Mm-hmm. But I do think just as an analytical matter, it's important to figure out what's or try to understand what's going on here. I mean, the fact is that women have come to dominate certain aspects of society since they've been liberated. And women do set the terms of a lot of things in society where they didn't used to have a voice. Men have been dethroned. So that's all there. And that's not a reason for fury.
No, but it's something we're not very good at speaking about.
No, we're not. And the other thing is, though, that as women were taking their rightful place in society, there were some women who were saying that masculinity itself needed to be like overhauled, and that we just can't have traditional masculinity anymore, that it's toxic, that it's not good, and we need to train men to be more like women. And men hate that.
Yeah.
And arguably, I mean, it's now old, 6 years ago, but I wrote a book where I talked about how it's important to recognize the unique contributions of masculinity, to praise the good aspects of masculinity, the protectiveness of men, their courage, their, you know, being willing to support their families, all those things, being good dads, which are really, you know, key features of good masculinity. But I think our society in general did fail for a while to uphold the good things about masculinity and focused too much on the negative aspects of masculinity. And this has provoked a backlash. What do you make of that?
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food. And before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I think that's a fair characterization in sort of generalities. I guess what I worry about with some of this and with like where we go next is, because I agree, I think that there's, men have... they have been dethroned. There's been this huge sort of turmoil, right? And period of pretty radical social change, including racial change for the last 50 years in our institutions, in our sort of prestigious institutions, right? And I think what we have now is a situation where the danger is that there's sort of a backlash or reversion and sort of forcing women back into the household exclusively and men, and then valorizing just a form of masculinity that still isn't very thoughtful.
It's horrible, actually.
Right. I mean, I don't mean the worst of it. I mean, even just like our old fashioned, I would worry about valorizing any one model. And I don't mean to be some sort of flaky postmodernist. I just mean, like, I think what we have to do is also accept that there are these kind of maybe natural standards or at least these, I'm not a gender theorist. You'll hear that very quickly. But I mean, there are these models of masculinity that are good, and femininity too. And that for a while, I think probably people maybe were discouraged from that, or at least weren't allowed to be that in the way that they might have wanted to. And so, I remember my mom was a stay-at-home mom. And I think she got a lot of snobbish, backlash might be too strong, right? But she got a lot of reaction against that. And that sucks,
Yeah.
And so there wasn't room for that. But I worry that we also have to make room for all the people who are really different and who don't fit into those norms. And we have to, all of us, conservatives and liberals together, just like make room for people, because, and also to, you know, and to also provide models for young people in the different forms that they might be, you know, attracted to or lean towards. But it's, I worry, you know, even with the trans stuff, I worry that the people who are going to struggle here most are, first of all, like trans people who are vulnerable, but also just like tomboys, you know, like there's always been all these different kinds of people. I'm a very normal, you know, whatever, what do we say, cis, whatever, like, I'm just like feminine person, you know, I don't struggle with any of this. Even then, you know, like the standards of society in terms of your ambition or how to be a professional in the world, those things do, I don't know. I think we have to find a way to talk about these things that allows people to kind of be drawn towards those older models, but also to explore different things. And it's very difficult. I mean, just, I don't know. That's, I don't have much of, that's very articulate to say about this, but I worry about it.
Those are very, very good points. And I guess I am a little bit, I'm over it now because I've been noticing this for 20 years, 25 years, but I'm kind of shocked that, or was shocked at the beginning, that conservatives who supposedly uphold older standards of conduct and who are always saying how civilized they are, as opposed to, you know, the left, which said, hey, if it feels good, do it. You know, right. It's anything goes. The conservatives are the one who said, no, we have to have standards about behavior. And that's all very important. And yet, when it came to men behaving badly, where you would think conservatives would be the first to say, hey, that's not on. That's not, you're not being a gentleman. You're not being a good father. You're not being a good husband. You're not being a whatever. And they were like, no, it's the women's fault. And I just, that again, I'm used to it now, but in the beginning I thought, well, hang on. I mean, I thought part of your whole shtick was having certain moral standards that you expect people to live up to.
Well, and isn't it true that any man I know who is a real gentleman doesn't find it hard?
No.
Doesn't find it hard to call these people out. Doesn't find it hard to, you know, say, let's release the Epstein files.
Right. Right. Exactly.
And, you know, and just stand up for women who, you know, not every time. I mean, doesn't mean that there isn't due process for men who are falsely, you know, all of those things matter too, but it's really shameful, I think, a lot of this stuff.
Yeah. Let's finish up on what we're seeing right now, which is just huge eruption within the MAGA world over anti-Semitism in mm-hmm. Israel and so forth. Can you sort of help us fit what's going on right now with TPUSA and all of this into your categories, and who's fighting whom, and where does anti-Semitism fit in? Are there certain mm-hmm. groups that are more anti-Semitic than others within the MAGA field, or how is this all working? Or is this another thing like misogyny that sort of they can all link arms and agree on? We hate the Jews.
No, they can't quit. This is the one issue that's not like misogyny and not like just everyday anti-Black racism or anti-immigration feeling, where actually there's some genuine, there has been a rupture, right? And I think it's sort of the least surprising thing in the world. You could see it coming. It's not like it's a big theme in my book, but it was all, but there are these moments where it's like Stephen Wolf. You could see these, especially in the underbelly. You saw this stuff bubbling up for a long time because Ben Shapiro and Candace Owens were going at it ever since October 7th. Mm-hmm. And there's mm-hmm. the kind of Christian nationalist, someone like Stephen Wolf, who is this Calvinist, He sort of hates Zionism, and you could see this sort of rumors of his anti-Semitism in the Christian right. Like, you could see all this sort of boiling up. And then you had Yoram Hazony in this very awkward position from the beginning, where he's just trying to say that basically pretending it's only a problem on the left.
Yeah.
Anti-Semitism. Meanwhile, you've got this really nasty stuff boiling up in his movement. And I mean, my book kind of chronicles how national conservatism did sort of radicalize. They started off early on saying racists aren't welcome here, but Amy Wax was at that conference, and then Darren Beattie had, you know, was speaking at the conference a few years later. Paul Gott Gottfried, just these really pretty questionable characters sort of seeping in to the movement, which is very much what was happening. Kevin Roberts at the Heritage Foundation sort of got on board with the NatCon movement in a very explicit way. So they were all kind of going in this radicalized direction. And then now, now that's blowing up in their faces because some of this stuff is really, you know, really bad in a way that the Republican voting public cares about and the donors care about, right? Because they're very committed to Israel. Traditionally, many Americans are.
Even if it's not that they're committed to Israel, even if it's just that they're anti-Semitism.
Oh, of course. Of course.
Yeah.
I think the politics of it, right? There's a kind of, well, why didn't this happen sooner? Like, why hasn't it happened over the misogyny and the racism? And I think that that becomes a bit of a political question, perhaps. I mean, I don't want to underplay the anti-Semitism. I mean, it's a really disgusting problem. And there's been I guess J.D. Vance said one mean thing about Fuentes, but I just think the guy, you know, he didn't say anything about Carlson, about Kevin Roberts, who's been pretty weak on all of this. So it's, I mean, to say the least. So
absolutely. And by the way, he couldn't even just denounce Fuentes. He had to lump it together with Jen Psaki and claim that he was attacking Jen Psaki equally with Nick Fuentes, which is so preposterous because Jen Psaki had not attacked his wife. She had merely asked whether his wife was okay under this onslaught of racism that is coming out. Oh, it's just
upside down. I mean, I think there is anti-Semitism on the left. I think that some of the, I think that the left hasn't sort of been covering itself in glory, but there, you know what else there's been? A lot of Islamophobia in this country. I mean, I get that but it's like there's complete silence on that. So the idea that the left is, I mean, I just think that what's happening is so much uglier, right? It's so much more sort of flagrant, this stuff on the right, so much more dangerous.
It is. Okay. Yeah. So if you were going to, like, let's imagine that we will get past this awful moment. Eventually, these people will pass from the scene, at least those who are currently in power. The end of your book, you talk about some proposals for changing the way we educate Americans, or, you know, and other things. So anything you want to close on that is like a program for reform to get us out of this hole?
Sure. I mean, I guess at the end of the book, I thought, well, I've got to say something sort of more on a positive or constructive note. And I'll say I'm a little bit, I think Patrick Deneen has some terrible philosophy in his books and like it's not very well thought through, but I liked some of his wacky proposals for our, for America, where it's like the mixed regime stuff, where I think he's right to see that there's a problem where we are too isolated from one another. The elites on the coast don't get enough time in the, you know, Midwest and vice versa. And so I like his proposals for, you know, national system of service programs. Moving some of the agencies around. I mean, I'm also in favor of sort of taxing the super wealthy and all of that, but that's a different question. I mean, but just this inequality is real. These social distortions are real. And I think that that's really important. And then I also do talk quite a bit in the book about higher education, because I think, as I noted earlier, one of the vulnerabilities that these guys are really exploiting is sort of liberal and mainstream Americans, lack of, well, there's sort of negligence of these questions of meaning, right? And I think it makes sense, you know, in the second part of the last century, people would get complacent. Life was pretty good for most middle-class Americans. And so there's a kind of complacency there. But a lot of the conservative criticisms of higher education, which were that they sort of have neglected moral virtue and formation and the great books and Western Civ and all of that, I'm not very sympathetic to as a historical matter when there was all this sort of churn and all this social change. But I think now it might be time to reassess some of those arguments and think maybe we do, as liberals, need to be more deliberate about how we educate young people in a pluralistic liberal democracy, right? Multiracial pluralistic democracy. While we need to do more civics education, especially in high school, but we also, and of a plural variety, and we also need to teach young people history, contentious history, right? History from different sides of the from different perspectives, and some of these great works of literature that I think universities do still teach. I'm not anti-woke and I'm not anti-higher ed, but I think that our institutions have really suffered from administrators and faculty too, who don't really understand the meaning of education, and especially of like free education for free people, which requires a kind of deep humanities education. And I think the time is ripe to really try to fund some of that, you know, in our big public schools, especially.
Yeah. Well, Laura K. Field, thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you for the book, which I learned so much from.
Thank you for reading. It was really nice to speak with you about it. And Merry Christmas, happy holidays.
Thank you. Same to you.